Hi, my name is Kunal, and welcome to the Geeks of the Valley podcast, which connects with some of the brightest minds globally who are leading their respective industries today to discuss the hottest upcoming industry trends and how their work is affecting the global economy. What started off as a coffee chat has now grown into a global platform for visionaries. This morning from Dubai, we are thrilled to have a very special guest joining us. He is the former senior partner and leader of McKinsey's payment practice across Asia Pacific and the former CEO of Oyo Vacation Homes. He is now on a mission to simplify Web3 payments for the next billion users across Asia with his new company, TransFi. With his deep expertise in the payments industry, we are excited to hear his insights on the future of payments and how TransFi is paving the way for financial inclusion in the era of Web3. So let's dive in and welcome our guest, Raj Kamal. Raj, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kunal. Privileged to be here. Thank you for having me on your show.
And how are things with you over there in Dubai?
Very nice. Dubai, I believe, is emerging as the Web3 capital of the emerging markets, if not the world. Lots of excitement. A lot of entrepreneurs and, Web3 enthusiasts in the city. All super good. I think the regulatory environment is also shaping up properly. So quite excited.
And really speaking about the regulatory environment, you have quite an interesting background. And can you tell us kind of a bit about your experience as a state regulator with the Indian government and how it informs your understanding of the current regulatory landscape when it comes to Web3, not just in India, but beyond across Asia?
Yeah. So, Kunal, I started off and spent the first 8 years of my career in the civil service in India. The civil service in India, if you're getting into that, it requires you to be trained in law, both civil law as well as criminal law. You actually have to clear all the exams, and then only you can, take any of the operational roles. My training actually is in law as part of, being in the civil services in India. During my operating roles in that service over, as I said, an eight-year stint, amongst the various things that I did, there were two which were notable. One is that you actually have, the right to act as a court on certain civil matters. So I actually had a practicing court and I had lawyers who would come and, plead cases, and I have written judgments. And the second is that, in that role, you actually end up drafting laws together with your legal counterparts. So I've been instrumental, for example, as the chief budget officer of my province in drafting, laws, including, for example, setting up of the public account of my province, which is like a massive thing. So that's the background which I have, right? Which is an understanding of law, having practiced as a court, and being instrumental in drafting laws. Now, what does it enable? One is that you just understand the language and interpretation of law. That is super critical, right? You need to understand the difference between may, will, and shall. They're three very different words. And you also need to know that ignorance of law is no defense. That's the first thing you'll be taught in any legal course. And I think that's very important, which is, I don't need to necessarily rely on the judgment of somebody who's telling me, but I can interpret quite a few things, based on my reading of law. And I've retained that skill. And I think that's number one. Number two, it also helps you understand the perspective and the concerns of regulators. And I think it's naive to actually assume that anybody in the government is basically wrong and anybody in Web3 is like this big savior of the world. That is never the truth. That's where it helps me just be a bit more open to stepping into the shoes of people who are drafting laws and regulations in their shoes. And as I said earlier, understanding the language of law and what something means and what something is trying to imply, right? So I think that's what I would say. My formal training in the civil services in India, where I started my career and spent the first 8 years, helps me too.
And as a former senior partner at McKinsey, you focused on this, on the payments practice across Asia Pacific. And how do you see kind of the rise of the Web3 industry impacting the traditional payments industry in the region?
So Kunal, I think, Web3 has multiple promises, right? And all of us are super excited about WorldCoin and how, it is going to completely reshape identity and movement using a singular identity across the globe, right? It's a pain to move from one country to another. And somebody who carries an Indian passport, I probably face more of that pain than many others. Now, having said that, I still believe that one of the biggest promises of Web3 is just revolutionizing and disintermediating traditional payments. Throughout my 12 years at McKinsey, where I spent a lot of time working with payments institutions and businesses across Asia Pacific, what was very obvious was that the payment systems that we had, especially the SWIFT-based cross-border and global payment system, is extremely inefficient. Internet is actually a messaging protocol. It is not a value transfer protocol. So the implication is that when you try and do payments on the internet, payments and settlement are disjointed. They don't happen real time. A message between your bank and my bank on a transfer between the two of us goes instantaneously, but there is an end of day net settlement between our two banks. And because they are disjointed, that creates the first set of issues. Now, building on that, what happens is that there is a huge issue of trust. So you have a very widespread network of correspondent banks and a system of nostro and vostro accounts, right? Every bank has a position in every other bank, which it is a correspondent to. And if you're not a correspondent to a key bank, then you need to find another bank who's a correspondent to a key bank. So for example, let's say I'm sitting in Dubai, and let's say my bank is First Abu Dhabi Bank. Now, First Abu Dhabi Bank, if it wants to transfer something to JP Morgan in the US, JP Morgan doesn't know First Abu Dhabi Bank, and First Abu Dhabi Bank does not know JP Morgan. I'm giving this as an example. So First Abu Dhabi Bank might have a correspondent banking relationship with, let's say, Emirates NBD, and Emirates NBD would then have a correspondent banking relationship with JP Morgan because trust is not there. And each of these two, two sets of transactions have their own nostro and vostro accounts going. So there is an issue with trust, which delays transaction. And then there is this issue with nostro and vostro accounts, which requires people to commit capital for the transaction to go through. Because as I said earlier, there's an end of day settlement happening and you don't want to be out of money for that end of day settlement to happen. And while, you and I may transfer like a couple of $100 between us, imagine this across the globe where there is hundreds of billions of dollars of transactions happening because there is interbank settlements, there is exchange transactions, there is big pension funds moving their money, there is a derivatives transaction, there is OTC trades going on, and you understand the extent of inefficiency in the system. Now, the third thing is that, some of the archaic technology also has its own problems. So, some of the issues with the traditional payment systems is that in many instances, data is actually captured in a text field. So you will always hear about people saying my invoice or my transaction has gone missing. And then you are calling up your bank and your bank is calling the correspondent and they're all trying to figure out what the hell has happened. And sometimes it takes days, sometimes it takes weeks. Small merchants across the globe struggle with lost transactions, which may take up to 2 months. And that's because sometimes, data is being captured in text when these transactions are happening, and that's all archaic technology. And these are issues which are well known, and I've seen these in my own, experiences through my stint at McKinsey. And I think the promise of Web3 actually is to enable value transfer protocols. You will not have the need for disjointed payment and settlement. The promise of Web3 is trustless, transactions to go through. You don't need the system of correspondent banks and Nostro and Vostro accounts. It can all be done in a trustless manners. And with the innovation of stable coins in particular, where you can peg it to a currency and potentially, emergence of, alternatives to value protocols, the opportunity to disintermediate traditional payments is just immense and here and now. And that's what excites me. So I think I've taken a long time to respond to your question, but I think essentially my learning during my stint at McKinsey was that traditional payments has a lot of inefficiencies. And while people have tried to solve for it, the structural answer to the solution emerges with Web3 and its promise.
When it comes to governments in Asia, how do you think they will respond to the increasing adoption of Web3 technologies, particularly in the context of financial regulation and consumer protection?
I will answer your question, Kunal, in two parts, right? I think overall, I expect, and in whatever interactions that I have done, I have the view that most governments are positive to the promise of Web3. Clearly, a government in the Philippines doesn't want remittances being received by Filipinos who are receiving their money from Filipino expatriates to be charged 3%, 4% for that transaction, which is true today. Clearly, no government in Asia, is the hub of manufacturing and technology exports in the world. No government in Asia wants, transaction costs on that for anybody who's sourcing or importing the manufacturing good or the digital good in the West to be actually paying 3, 4, 5% transaction charges. So they clearly, are interested in solving for these real world use cases. And I think, that is what you see, for example, in regulators in Hong Kong coming up recently with a framework to enable, Web3 to emerge in a compliant manner. You've seen that from the regulators in the UAE. You've seen, regulators in Singapore, Indonesia, all of these begin to talk about these and find ways to solve for this because the value of the opportunity is immense. And I think that is largely positive. Now, you touched upon, the specific word of financial stability and consumer protection. Now, that is always going to be a concern of the regulator that, yes, we want benefits and we want improvements. We want to lower the overall transaction costs. But while it is happening, what we don't want is for bad actors to come and mess around with, consumer protection. And we also don't want the traditional financial system to suffer from any instability because somebody has been super aggressive or has done something which they didn't understand the consequences of. And I think those are fair concerns. I think where we are today, the world is kind of mixed, right? So I think the regulators want the positive things. They have concerns on consumer protection and on financial stability. And at least there's been a bit of a tendency in the last 1 year for regulators to more whisper than regulate, which is always very problematic and doesn't help, industry evolve in the right way. And my request to the regulators would always be not to whisper, but to regulate, say exactly what is allowed and what is not allowed, because it helps, people who want to build compliant businesses like TransFi to do the right things and avoid what is not allowed. Equally, there is a bit of a outshouting which is going on in the Web3 community, where everything which comes from the regulators is bad, and all kinds of very, very, you know, colorful words are used, which I think is not helpful, because clearly, you know, $100 trillion global payments infrastructure is not going to be disintermediated by Web3 if the regulators don't allow it. It is not happening. We might think we are, you know, these, you know, super, cool builders of the future in Web3. But if the regulators don't let you touch the traditional payment system, the Web3 world on its own will never, be able to cross the barrier of regulatory hurdle. So I think, again, a long answer to your short question, but in synthesis, what I would say is that I think regulators are positive on the opportunity. They are concerned about bad actors and what they could do to consumer protection and to financial stability. I can only request the regulators to regulate and not whisper. And in our Web3 community, my own view is that we just need to grow up and realize that finding a way to engage the regulators will open up far more opportunities than using colorful words about them.
So taking a step back, I know we've talked about payments at a high level, both from the banking and the government perspective, and it's tied to Web3. How does TransFi, the company you've started, plan to disrupt the Web3 payments ecosystem, and what unique advantages does it offer compared to other players in the space?
Yeah, so Kunal, thanks for also giving me a chance to talk about TransFi. I think our motto is instant real time, low cost transactions in local payment methods, in local currencies with best in class conversion rates. Right? That's what we are focused on, and each of these words are important. Right? We design ourselves to be real time and instant, and I think that leads to Web3 being the core of how we enable the payments to happen. Now, in an ideal world, that would mean just a transaction between one coin to the other, but that's probably a few years out, right? I don't think that's here and now. So for us, therefore, it becomes very important to enable fiat to digital asset and digital asset to fiat transactions to happen, in addition to a digital asset to digital asset transaction to happen, especially when it concerns with stable coins. And that's what we that's what our core product offering is. We offer it for individuals, we offer it for high net worth individuals, we offer it for large corporates. We enable own party transactions, which is you can move money from your fiat account to a stable coin. We enable it as third party pay in and payout transactions. So for example, one of our customers wants to pay out salaries and commissions to freelancers in a one-to-many transaction, which is across fiat and digital assets, right, from the US to Asia. So that's what we enable as a product, right? And that's what we look to offer. As we are building this, our thesis is that this has to be done with availability in local payment methods and local currencies, and therefore we actually partner with licensed payment systems and gateways across different parts of Asia to be able to enable transactions to happen, let's say in the in Vietnam with Momo and Zalopay, in Indonesia with Dana and OVO, and so on and so forth, right? So we create that ability to be able to do that through local payment systems and in local currencies. And we build a wide network of payment gateways and payment systems with whom we have onboarded to create this ability. The third part is, I said high conversion rates. Our simple thesis is that in the world of payments, every hop is a conversion killer. So we try and control the entire journey of the user. And therefore, you know, at this stage, for all the local payment methods and local currencies that we support, our target and where we are today is like 90% plus conversion rates. You will not hear those numbers for many, many other players. And that's because we just take control of most of the process and reduce the number of hops. And I think that's where, we try and get these high conversion rates. But all of this is meaningless if you are going to do it at, again, 3, 4, 5% transaction costs. And therefore, it is important to find ways to lower the costs of transaction. Now, in an ideal world, you should argue that financial institutions, payment systems, payment gateways, who you are partnering with, they should, be giving you lower rates in partnerships with you, because eventually you are, doing real-time settlements and reducing the need for large balances in Nostro and Vostro accounts. But we are not there fully right now. The reality is that the moment you go and speak to any payment system and you say, I am in the digital asset or Web3 space, you are classified as a high-risk customer and you're given some obnoxious rates, right? That's just the reality of life. But how do we still solve for the cost question? Because if I'm going to do a Filipino peso transaction in like 3 to 4%, I'm not offering any pricing benefit. So we actually think of managing our own treasury and liquidity and manage local pools of capital. We don't like a lot of movement between fiat and crypto transactions. So let's say we are dealing with transactions in Malaysia. What we are getting is paying transactions where we are receiving Malaysian ringgit, and we're doing payout transactions where Malaysian ringgits are going out, and we try and maximize, use of local pools of capital so that the actual conversion from Malaysian ringgit to a USDT or USDT to a Malaysian ringgit is minimized. And really, this concept of local pools of capital helps us, drive lower costs. So if you look at all of these together, right, real time, local payment methods and local currencies, high conversion rates and low cost is how we have structurally built our business on. And I've given you the logic of how it's being done. We are already seeing traction. And, at some point in time, we believe that as we see, large volumes of transactions, we'll also be sitting on a huge amount of data that also has the potential to get monetized, right? We haven't got to that stage as of now, but that's the future opportunity for us, right? But this is how we think of, TransFi's uniqueness and how we have constructed our platform.
So then, Raj, how does TransFi plan to balance innovation and regulatory compliance as it expands into services in different markets?
Yeah, so the reality, Kunal, is that I don't think we have the opportunity to balance. I think we just have to do both. Innovation is required because, if you're not offering instant low cost in local payment methods and local currency transactions with high conversion rates, you don't have a chance of winning, right? And I think that's a given. Equally, given what has happened in the last 12 months in particular, I don't think there is a lot of leeway on the issue of compliance. So we just have to do both, right? And we try and find the best possible solution in our journey. Now, obviously, the end answer for us would be to get our own entities and licenses in every jurisdiction with doing direct regulatory reporting and be compliant in that manner. And that's something that we would like to get to, but clearly that's an expensive journey and we are not there today. But we try and find a way to be compliant with the constraints that we have by ensuring that we are partnering with licensed players. And Kunal, you can't imagine the amount of due diligence and compliance onboarding we go to with every single partner with onboard. I have been grilled for 2 hours at a stretch by compliance teams asking all kinds of questions after like a 6 month journey in the final call. And after they have been fully satisfied, then they say, okay, now we will open our rails for you. So that's how we try and balance, which is ideally we would want all licenses ourselves, but we can't get to that on day one. It's a journey and it'll take time. And till then, we find other partners who have the licenses so that we can construct the business in a compliant manner. But genuinely, I think we would like to be standing up and saying in every jurisdiction that we are complying with laws and regulations. And that's something which I think is a unique differentiator of Transcept. We are not trying to beat around on compliance.
And to wrap up a call with our last question for the day, looking ahead, from your perspective, what do you see as the biggest opportunities and challenges for the Web3 payments ecosystem? And how do you think companies like TransFi will shape its evolution?
I think the biggest opportunity is the disintermediation of the $100 trillion payments ecosystem. Look at cross-border remittances. Look at cross-border trade. Look at interbank settlements. Look at exchange settlements. Look at derivative settlement. Look at OTC trades. These are like massive opportunities with a lot of inefficiency. You know, I was between my McKinsey stint and TransFi, I was also an investor. And I had once gone to meet a young Web3 startup in New York City. And they were showing us how OTC derivative settlements between banks in New York City was being done on Excel. And I fell off my chair. I couldn't imagine that this was being done on Excel. So apart from, you know, it being inefficient, it's also just extremely risky. And I think that is a huge opportunity waiting to be disintermediated. And that is really, you know, what we are gunning for. And that's what where we would like TransFi to be positioned and be successful. I think, you know, in our journey, you touched both the keywords, right? In our journey, you know, we see us building a business on two pillars. One is just continuously innovating and then being compliant at all times, right? And that's what we see as the two pillars. From our perspective, you know, we see our role in shaping the discussion in whichever shape or form we can, whether it is with you know, other players in the industry, with traditional financial institutions, with regulators. Wherever we get a chance, we try and get our point across. And we try and come across as you know, serious people with solid backgrounds who are looking to build real-world use cases using the power of Web3.
And Raj, for people out there who are interested in catching a cup of coffee with you, learning more about your startup or potentially investing, what would be the best point of contact?
I think, you know, my Telegram handle at @1RajKamal you know, email at raj.kamal@transfi.com. You know, I think those two are good places to reach me at.
Raj, it was a pleasure having you on Geeks of the Valley, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me today, Kunal. Really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.